Hello and welcome back to Album with me, Arslan Mohammed. And thank you so much for all the feedback about our last episodes about Heathen. There's been a lot of people writing in and commenting on how the podcast had urged them to scuttle back and discover this often overlooked album. And to be honest, one of the nice parts about doing this podcast is that I get to listen to albums as well, which I haven't really heard for a while. And when you get someone like Nick Pegg on board, who can just go on and on about every song in amazing detail and uncover so many hidden layers and anecdotes and insights, well, listening again to the album becomes a whole new thing. So yeah, I'm really happy that a lot of you seem to feel that way. So thank you, and thank you for getting in touch. Now, this time around, we're going to go back and do an album that has previously been done. In fact, it was the first album we ever did on Album to Album. It's Space Oddity. And to do it, we have the BBC Radio 4 Newswatch and front row presenter and general cultural maven and journalist legend, Samira Ahmed. Samira and I had been planning to get together for a while to have a bit of a Bowie chinwag. She's a big fan. Our plans were repeatedly beset by life acting up, as it so often does. But when we did meet finally a few months ago in London, it turned out that we had arrived at our meeting place with different albums in mind. I had thought we were to discuss the 1967 debut album David Bowie, while Samira was busy researching the ins and outs of her personal favourite, 1969's David Bowie. Well, the latter, as we all know, is usually appended man of words, man of music, but that just sounds ridiculous, doesn't it, in a canon replete with names such as Heroes, Scary Monsters, Black Star, The Man Who Sold the World, and so on. But nevertheless, our mutual surprise soon vanished, and we embarked on a far-reaching and incredibly enjoyable conversation that really touches on a whole load of things. We talked about alienation, growing up with Bowie, Bowie's impact on Asian kids growing up in the UK in the 1970s, Samira's excellent documentary on female Asian Bowie fans, and much, much, much more. Now, as with our recent Nick Pegg epic on Heathen, there was so much ground that we covered here that I actually split the podcast into two halves. So again, this is actually part one of a two-part discussion. And when you get into it, I think you'll understand why I've done that. Samira has so much to say and so many really interesting insights, not only into the album of Space Oddity, but into what Bowie meant to her and what Bowie meant to Asian kids growing up. And being an Asian kid who grew up in Britain myself, I found that really interesting to listen to and to participate in. So settle down, maximum comfort levels, doors set to automatic, and blast off. And may God's love be with you.
The stranger who's flown in from Berlin.
And the stranger from Berlin.
Very appropriate.
Indeed, indeed. But I've finally made it. Yeah, it's wonderful to have you on. And you've chosen for this talk David Bowie, Space Oddity.
Yes,
which is the album from 1969. And
yes, I have it in front of me. And it was given to me, I should say. It was only given to me a few years ago after the 40th anniversary edition came out. And I need to start with apology, which is, this is where, for someone who's made a documentary about David Bowie and writes and talks a lot about him, I managed to confuse Arslan by thinking this was his first album. there you go.
That's the sound of me ripping up my notes.
Yeah. But you know, hey, go, you know, play it, you know, loose.
Improvise.
Unlike the Beatles, and anyone who's heard my kind of I Am the Egg Pod on the Hard Day's Night knows I know those albums inside out. I did not grow up with David Bowie listening to his albums. I grew up with him kind of haunting me. He sort of got inside my head. And that's from seeing him on television and hearing single Space Oddity on the radio, probably around the time it got to number one in 1975, and being genuinely terrified, left cold at
the
idea.
It's spooky, isn't it?
Yes. And, you know, there are not that many pop songs that actually send a chill through you, and that was one of them. I can remember feeling really distressed after hearing that, driving in the back of my parents' car. And over the years, he's always been, as I say, he's gone inside my head and messed with it in the most wonderful way. But I never bought any of his records. I think the first David Bowie record I bought was probably a Greatest Hits compilation in the 90s. But I knew his music and I used to listen to it on the radio and I used to watch all the videos and they were a very important part. I think the first album I actually bought is that weird one where he's got a blue face and it's like Stained Glass Window, and it's the bonus CD version of it has tracks from Labyrinth.
Tonight. Yeah, you know, that's a Gilbert and George.
That would make sense. Cover. And it's got a terrible one terrible track on it, which is his cover of God Only Knows. Well, that one particularly is the worst cover song I've ever heard.
Right.
And I think it's quite interesting that David Bowie is a genius, but actually he could do something as misconceived as that one track. But, you know, and I'm the first to admit it's not a great album, but I think I bought it because it had songs off Labyrinth.
Yeah.
And then after I made my David Bowie documentary, and I think possibly, most of me before he died, my husband got me this album. And he got me the 40th anniversary limited edition with the poster.
I love it.
And lots
yeah.
of sleeve notes. And you know the great thing, so I hadn't heard this album, a new Space Oddity, and I put it on when he gave it to me and I listened to it and I thought, what a beautiful album. What a perfect album. So I approach this as someone who's in a sense quite new to David Bowie albums.
Right.
And I bought all I bought them all on vinyl secondhand over the years.
Right.
But literally only within the last 5 or 6 years.
So you have quite a comprehensive collection now. But this was the album, really, that has a...
This is the only David Bowie album that I've sat and listened to regularly.
Right, right.
Whereas the others, I kind of know all the songs, and I've listened to them on Spotify, and I do have them on vinyl now. But it wasn't about the albums. David Bowie is not about the albums. It's everything that he represents. You know, he's a sort of... He is more of a messianic figure, I think.
Well, I want to get on to everything that he represents to you during the course of the podcast, but just to back up a moment, now you just mentioned a David Bowie documentary. What was that?
So I made a documentary for Radio 4 called I Dressed Ziggy Stardust, and it came about in 2012 when I had recently gone freelance. And I, thanks to social media, you know, you find people you've always admired. So Sharma Pereira, the journalist and broadcaster, was a huge... role model of mine when I was growing up, and we got in touch via Twitter and we met up, and she told me the story about how she used to hang out around Haddon Hall, and she'd got to know Angie and David Bowie, and she'd sent in costume sketches, including one for a one-arm, one-legged thing. And one day David Bowie came up and ruffled her hair and said, "You're coming to the Palais next week, you're going to have a surprise." And she saw her costume completely, obviously, made into something original by that amazing Japanese designer.
Oh, Kansai Yamamoto,
But she had letters from Angie and everything, and she lost them all over the years. But I just thought, what a story, because she was growing up a few years older in North London, I was growing up in South London. I was very scared and very protected and, you know, very scared of David Bowie, in a sense. He represented something quite disturbing to me. And she was hanging out outside his flat and going for breakfast with some of his bandmates, and Mark Bolan would drive by in his white Rolls Royce and wave at the schoolgirls.
So she was living on the wild side.
Yeah, she was, you know, and so she has such a great story. So I wanted to make a documentary where the two of us kind of explored each other's version of David Bowie and London.
Wow.
And so in the end, the documentary, although we hadn't deliberately planned it that way, ended up being entirely female voices. So Cherry Vanilla, who was doing his PR, she talked to us about the fans. And you realise there are all these supportive women around David Bowie. And of course, it was his female fans that made him. Rupert Huck is now MP for Ealing.
Yes.
Is a sociologist by training and an academic. So she'd done all this great analysis on what David Bowie represented, a suburban boy, these ideas of the alien in the suburbs. And Shami Chakrabarti, who again then was at Liberty, turned out also to be a huge David Bowie fan. So we had quite an interesting bunch of women. And then we found a woman in Wales who had come as a refugee from Uganda as a child, was obsessed, I think, particularly with Mark Bolan, even more so than David Bowie, but loved that whole androgyny thing. And they reminded her of Lord Krishna. And she became a Hindu priest. And we know that, you know, in Hinduism, it's still, you know, incredibly unusual for women to become priests. And
right.
so they'd inspired so many interesting women in so many interesting ways. So that documentary got made, and it turned out to be around the time he came out of his retirement and released that album.
The next day?
I think so.
2013?
It was the penultimate album.
Yes, the next day.
2013. Yeah. And so it was just a great bit of coincidence.
That's marvellous.
Yeah.
I mean, that seems to throw up so many topics just within that brief précis.
And we should say, it's on iPlayer still. So
is it still available on
iPlayer? Yeah.
Okay, so do check it out on iPlayer. You touched on a number of themes there, the appeal of Bowie to people who might feel slightly marginalised, who might feel that they are representing the other. You mentioned refugees coming from Uganda. Something else which you touched on there is the androgyny aspect of it. And there's direct correlation there to depictions of especially Hindu gods and so on. There's so much material. And again, it kind of comes back to this fundamental question, which really is at the heart of this podcast series, which is, what does David Bowie mean to you? And how do you relate to David Bowie? And what are the kind of weighs in that that appeal most to you?
I mean, it's hard to take that question that way. I just think, I mean, for example, he's someone I never thought I'd want to meet. because what he represented was too significant, and in a way I'd be worried about being disappointed. But I just think it's his genius. And I was reading the sleeve notes for this album, and you know, there was some quite significant classical musician who said he'd never known anyone as talented as him, and you could tell that in the late 60s when he was working this. I suppose part of what's fascinated me about David Bowie, if I boiled it down to a couple of things, is seeing him through my mother's eyes, because in the early to mid 70s the androgyny and that glam rock thing really freaked out a lot of parents. Yeah. And you could see why if you look back. It really is
quite astounding.
You've got
your mother in a world. She's not sure if you're a boy or a girl.
Exactly. And she called me into the room one day. She was watching, I don't know if it was Nationwide, it was some kind of quite serious TV interview. And it was David Bowie sitting there with no makeup on being interviewed. And she said, oh, got to come and see this. It's David Bowie. And he's so handsome without all that makeup. And he's so intelligent. And the fact that my mother had thought to come and get me and tell me this, I just thought, this is the thing about him. He kind of cuts through all the assumptions people make about pop music, about pop stars, and was sort of ahead of his time in every category. And one of the things we did in the interview is we interviewed one of his former girlfriends, who is Dana Gillespie. Forgive me, I made an error. And you're, of course, a singer and a performer in her own right. And she talked about going to his house once and feeling that he was a stranger in his own home. And I don't know David Bowie's, you know, I've read biographies of his, but, you know, I'm not interested in dwelling on that, other than I think there's something that Asian immigrants recognise, a lot of immigrants recognise, in the story of a working class boy who feels trapped by his limitations and has a very specific dream of something bigger. And if you went to the V&A exhibition, you know, David Bowie is, there was a copy of the Observer Guide to Music, which he and a friend of his used to teach themselves. And that sense of almost like school assignments, working out what he needed to do and plugging at it. And similarly, I'm also fascinated, and I was with the Beatles too, by the very early days, what gets them going, and the kind of the bud rather than the full-blown rose. So if you look at all the early incarnations of the band, like the Conrads and all the rest of it, he tries out a multiplicity of styles, some of them not particularly cool, but he's interested in being famous, and he's commuting into Carnaby Street to hang out and get photographed, and he's in the background of some fashion shoots, and then he does that lolly advert as part of a 60s group, the Love Lolly. And, you know, there's something...
Do you know that was directed by Ridley Scott?
It's hilarious. But there's something brilliant about the fact that he wasn't snooty, he wanted to be famous, and people mock, you know, those going into talent shows now. But David Bowie would have been going on Pop Idol or The X Factor now, wouldn't he?
Did you read the story that's just come out now about the BBC report on, what was it, November 1965, when I think it was then the lower third came in for an audition to the BBC? And
that was one of his early bands, wasn't it?
Yeah, and because they've just announced now the documentary coming out next year, the first 5 years, and in that, they found this BBC internal review of the band, and it's hilarious because it's whoever obviously auditioned them that day was having a really bad day, because the singer was unappealing. He was clearly a cockney. He had no redeeming qualities or something. It was a really harsh review. And,
And that's, you know what, that's the most horrifying thing. It's the class snobbery.
That was very much.
That's the biggest thing about my fascination with David Bowie, is he represents all outsiders who don't conform to this idea of what is deemed establishment, deemed appropriate. And pop music was actually pretty classist in many ways in the 60s. It was kind of run by aristocrats.
It was run by aristocrats. It was peopled by the working class. I mean, I think since the late 50s when you had working class heroes, I mean, going back to people like Tommy Steele, for example, you know, like these real working class lads becoming pop stars. And then, of course, then the Beatles changing everything to the point where posh kids were trying to talk like Scousers.
I know.
Which was amazing.
If you think about a film like Privilege, you know, the Peter Watkin film, which, although it's so politically angry that I think it's too heavy-handed, but there is something really appropriate, if you think about the early David Bowie trying to break out, about this film, you know, about a pop star who's controlled by big business. And if you listen to the accents in the boardroom where they're discussing Paul Jones's career, it's all terribly, terribly posh. And they're all talking about marketing him. And, of course, in the film, they have this fanciful idea that he could be used to market the Church of England and all kinds of things, which seems less realistic now. But I think this idea of pop music channeling working class and young people's energy and the potential to try and manipulate it is, I can see why people were worried about it. And David Bowie's kind of in there as someone who wants to be a star. And you could imagine a different version of him getting caught up and being chewed up and spat out. And the fact that he endured despite that sneering review at the BBC tells you so much.
Oh, he had resilience, all right. I mean, the amount of knockbacks he got in the 60s. So there were these auditions. Do you remember seeing that clip when he appeared on the Cliff Michelmore show in 1964, which was a blatant attempt just to get his face on TV?
Was that the thing about the Society for the Protection of Long Hair?
And it's so funny when you see him, and he's doing this Michelmore show. And again, the class thing, because of course the whole establishment, the entertainment establishment, were very crusty upper-class men. So David, what's all this about? Laughing is terrible. They're all laughing at us and calling us darling. I don't like it at all.
Oh, yeah, it was better than that. In fact, when he died, I kind of wrote a sort of personal take on his life for The Guardian, and I was rereading it yesterday, and I quoted that interview, and his lines are so good. You know, there was another one about, you know, where's your handbag?
They say, where's your handbag? When you see him, he looks like a sort of Dickens urchin.
He does.
You know, he's got these appalling teeth, and he's like doing that whole sort of cheery, cockney, chappy thing.
And there's no underestimating his voice. I mean, I haven't heard those early recordings, so I'd be interested to hear what his kind of rockabilly incarnation sound like. But the thing about this album, considering it's... I mean, it's a very polished album, and it's mostly produced by Tony Visconti as well, is from... I just remember putting it on the turntable after I got given it as a present, thinking, I don't know any of the songs in this apart from Space Oddity. And every single song just... takes you somewhere. They're quite disturbing. They've got amazing lyrics. They're beautifully constructed. There's all kinds of things going on in there. And this is before he's done any of the stuff that he became famous for. Like.
Exactly. But that's interesting that you say that each song grabbed your attention in some way, because there's such a variety of songs here. I just want to go back very briefly to the first album he did, just because that is a great starting point for us to come to hear. The first album, which was recorded in 1966, 67, and came out on the same day as Sgt. Pepper.
I did not know that.
And reached a staggering 125 in the UK album charts.
And you probably had to sell like tens of thousands of copies to do that.
Yeah, but it was... The thing is, that album was a really fascinating little album. It was very Kinksy, it was very Sid Barrett-y, you know, it was very vaudeville music hall. But it kind of contained all these crazy ideas, but it flopped so profoundly. And in 68, his record label, Duram, dropped him. And then I think it's amazing that, I mean, these days, an artist like that who had been rejected time and time again, do you think they would be given another album contract?
No one gets an album contract.
I think Phillips originally released this album. And he got the chance to record these songs. Now, in that space of 2 years, he'd gone from doing The Laughing Gnome and these sort of chirpy, you know, music hall type songs, to this, which is such an eclectic... It's quite a dark album,
it feels like it's quite vulnerable. I mean, there's sort of this specific, you know, mournful love letters on there to you know, girlfriends who've left him. And in a way, I'm amazed that he sort of opens his heart so bare so early on. And it's the opposite to what I think a lot of people associate with David Bowie, which is the persona that he puts on and hides himself behind. But I won't be the first or the last person to say this on your podcast, but he's the ultimate artist. You know, that's who he is, and he was born that way. And I think the fact that he came from a genuinely working class background and managed to break out at the time he did is all further proof of his talent and his kind of single-minded focus.
We are lucky this happened. I mean, when I was reading about the 67 album before coming here,
because that's what you thought we were going to talk about. I'm really sorry.
No, it's funny. I found this wonderful anecdote. So Ken Pitt was his manager in the late 60s. And Ken Pitt really was an old school showbiz manager. You know, he really knew the game inside out. And he took over from Bowie's then manager, I think, Ralph Horton, who was a bit of a wheeler dealer. He was a bit hopeless, basically. And there's a very funny story that they were trying to get Bowie a publishing deal, and it wasn't really happening. And Ken Pitt laboriously negotiated finally. I think he got... maybe 5,000, not a huge amount, from a British publisher for the rights to all Bowie's material for the next, say, 2-3 years. But he felt he could do better, so he just told that publisher to wait. He had a business trip to the States, and while he was in the States, as well as getting things like an acetate of the first Velvet Underground album and meeting up with Warhol, he came back with a possible $30,000 deal. And he was so excited to tell Bowie. And then just before he told Bowie, he found out that Ralph Horton had gone in and accepted a deal for half. So he ended up with like £500, something like that. and it was devastating. But if Bowie had had that 30,000 in 67, who knows what direction his career would have gone in. The main thing that was stymieing his career at that point was that record labels weren't supporting him. DRAM, Pi, Philips, they didn't know how to promote him. And with that budget, I think it was in either Nick Pegg's, I think it was in Nick Pegg's book, this alternate reality where Bowie had sort of scored these big hits with songs like Love You Till Tuesday and Laughing Gnome, and ended up being like a sort of Vegas cabaret act or something, and dying mysteriously in the early 80s. But no, instead we got Space Oddity, and obviously the expectations weren't high when he started recording this, because after all, he'd had all these flops. And then what we get here is an album which, okay, the title track is the scary title track that scared you as a youngster. It's such an odd song, and Tony Visconti, who was very early in his relationship with Bowie, actually refused to work on it.
Yeah, no, he didn't like it.
He didn't like it. He was like, this is beneath you. You're demeaning yourself. This is a novelty song. So they got Gus Dudgeon, the man that had produced The Laughing Gnome, because it was really regarded as on a par with The Laughing Gnome.
Novelty song.
Yeah, it's coming to Space Oddity. But Space Oddity is one of those songs that has really intrigued critics, writers, Bowie files over the years, with such a rich, so rich with allusion, so rich with metaphor.
But also, you know, what's interesting is it does sit very happily as the opening track on this album. I think it doesn't jar with what else is on it, because all of the songs are distinctive and they've all got a strange, eerie, otherworldly tone to them. So it's not like an album where that hit single has been stuck on it and the rest of the album is overshadowed at all, I don't think. The other thing I realised, and this is the closest I have to a personal connection with David Bowie, is I used to work at BBC World Service and there was a producer there called Caroline Finnegan, whose mother is Mary Finnegan.
Mary Finnegan, right.
And I'd forgotten it, and I think it's when I was making my documentary, I'd completely forgotten this, so I never contacted Caroline. But I remembered Caroline would tell me how when David Bowie came to stay, because Mary, you know, and him ran the arts lab in Beckenham together, she was a teenager, and she was like, oh, you know, you have to give up your bedroom because David Bowie's going to sleep in there. So she would have David Bowie in her room and she had to go and share with her brother or whatever. But she just remembers him being so lovely. And I suppose it was a bit like having this slightly magical figure come in your house. But also, if you think about Beckenham, and I don't know if you've ever been to that pub where the Arts Lab was.
The Three Tuns.
I mean, it's, you know, it's real suburban. Imagine even more so in the late 60s. But I met, for the documentary, we met a couple of people who'd been there. And there's a photographer called High Money who went, and she talked about how, one, just the amazing eclectic atmosphere of this place, where you had all these artists coming through and you had sitar players, and it was very multicultural and not dissimilar.
This was the Arts Lab.
Yeah, and this is not dissimilar to the kind of Indian-influenced London scene of the Beatles, but it's happening out in Beckenham.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's astounding in itself. But also, I think, again, at a time when there was a lot of racism in London, High Money, who was Anglo-Indian in the kind of, you know, the sense of coming from an Anglo-Indian family there, that mixed race within India, and had come to Britain on her own and sort of rejected her Asian side and, you know, tried to be as British as possible because that had been raised. And went to the Arts Lab and went to David Bowie's house as a photographer to photograph. She, I think she took her children and she took her children's friends. And she talked about how going inside it was full of incense and Indian textiles and fabrics. And was profoundly moved in our interview, remembering how almost seeing David Bowie embrace Indian art made her appreciate her own hybrid culture. And that was the thing. You know, he was a non-racist, he was non-binary, he was happy to be thought of as being gay at a time when it had only just been partially decriminalised. And I think the biggest thing for me, and the seminal video for me, is the 1979 Boys Keep Swimming video, when he cross-dresses, is why would a white, conventional, handsome, well-spoken man want to draw attention and be controversial and be thought of as gay or be androgynous when we know, you know, mainstream British society will hate you and they will, you know, threaten you and they could be violent towards you. And the idea that he would choose to embrace difference at a time when immigrant children were desperate to avoid being
standing
noticed
out,
because it usually meant racist threats. That was quite a moment.
I think you put your finger on it there with, I remember, I grew up in a very quiet part of the world, me and my sister. I mean, we were one of the very few Asian families in that part of the world.
Whereabouts was it?
Wellington in Telford. And it was a very nice childhood. We had very few problems, but speaking to our cousins or Asian friends who grew up in cities, that notion, especially in the early 80s, it was like, you know, you keep your head down, you don't attract attention.
Well, no, the whole National Front phenomenon in the late 70s was very, very strong.
Yeah, and that's very recent, isn't it? I mean, we're not talking about hundreds of years ago. This is just in our lifetimes.
And can we not get into that alleged fascist salute thing? Because I feel that's been gone over so much.
Oh, God, no, no, no.
Because I just think it's confusing and it's irrelevant.
It's not true. I've been involved in conversations on this for ages now. It's really not true, but no. Well, let's go back to Space Odyssey.
Okay.
So, are there any other points you want to make about the title track?
Well, I'm interested that he was really influenced by the Stanley Kubrick film.
Yes, 2001.
Yeah, and I think that sense of this isolated figure floating in space. I mean, a lot of it is imagery that he's conjured up from the film.
Yeah.
And I'm quite interested in that. And also, which I think the sleeve notes talk about a bit, is the fact that both this song and the film used engineering technology to create something alien. So if you think about Douglas Trumbull, who did the special effects for 2001, and basically invented new technology, he's an engineer by training, to create that whole Stargate sort of sequence, which went on for ages with the flashing lights. It still holds up. And I've interviewed him. It's amazing how it comes down to, I need to invent some new science to be able to visualise what's in my head or what's in Stanley Kubrick's head. And I think David Bowie is very good at doing that. So there's all kinds of interesting, weird sounds on this. And I can't remember, I spent there's a Mellotron on there. And
it's pretty, what was it called? The stylophone.
The stylophone.
The stylophone's on there. And I'm sure everyone was using Mellotrons at the end of the 60s. Yeah. There's got to be a Mellotron on there somewhere. But there's that lovely clip of him on the BBC doing, I think, either for Top Gear or someone. And it could be DLT or Peele was interviewing him, and of course they're all very posh in those days, like we were saying, and he was saying, so do you think you could do that live in the studio? And he said, well, no, I think it'd take about three orchestras to do that, and we just can't afford that at all. But
it's constructed sound.
That's why I think Visconti rather looked down on it, because it required the sort of sound effects and stuff which Bowie was synonymous with earlier.
And yet, if you listen to what makes it a strong song, it's very simple analog things like the guitar, the beginning. And so for me, part of the power of the song is it starts with the guitar being faded in so quietly, you're aching, waiting till you can make out the first sound of it. And I think a song that isn't afraid to do that rather than having to start in hard. So all the effects that are constructed within the song don't change the fact that at heart, it's a song you can strum on a guitar.
It is. It's very, very simple. It's just a C, that's it. And I love that gentle fading in. I mean, it really sets the scene, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also, you know, I mean, there was stuff about it was played in the BBC's coverage of the moon landing, wasn't it? And how I know people who can remember the moon landings, and they talk about just how amazing it was. And I think it still is. I mean, when was the last time we saw anything live from space? We don't. We don't see it. But it would be amazing if we saw live landing on Mars. So
did they play the whole song? I mean, that would be rather scary.
Apparently the BBC had a rule that no one was supposed to play any space-related pop songs on the radio around the moon landing. Maybe they thought it would be in bad taste if something went wrong, God knows what. But somehow this song got played. So, and yet, weirdly, it didn't go to number one then. It wasn't to its re-release.
It wasn't a big hit then, was it?
No. But I think, again, if you think about the lyrics, and part of the power is, of course, you know, the song starts off very optimistic, and it's quite cynical already about fame, and, you know, they want to know whose shirts you wear. And then when something goes wrong, and it suddenly turns into a disaster film.
Yeah.
It's very much got the tone of those late 60s dystopian science fiction films, hasn't it?
He was really into all those films, wasn't he? He was a massive sci-fi nerd. And I think that definitely, that feeds into this.
Yeah, and I think that's the one thing about 2001. It's a film which, it is a cold film in many ways, and I admire it. But the thing that I can never get over is I feel really bad for that astronaut, you know, who's up there on his own. And I'm not sure he wants to be the star child. I think he'd like to go home.
I think there's a degree of ambiguity in this song. You could interpret it as being the Major Tom character actually wants to be set free, or, you know, wants to commit some self-sabotage and just float off into the nothingness, or there is some sort of communications failure. I love that ambiguity of it. You're never quite sure.
Oh, so I disagree. I think whole thing is it's an accident, and it's the idea you find yourself because of chance.
Right.
You're stranded, and the idea of going off into space alive. It's a trope that comes up in a lot of science fiction, and it's always the most chilling. The idea of being trapped forever and dying a slow death on your own. There's an episode of Space 1999 when someone tricks his way onto a ship that's heading for Earth. But because the cryogenic chamber hasn't been set for him, he thinks he's woken up and they've arrived on Earth, and he realizes it's only been a few hours, and he's trapped in this thing, and everyone else around him is in deep hibernation, and he's going to die. He's going to starve to death and
That's
die trapped in this glass
visceral,
thing.
Visceral, horrible.
And on Moonbase Alpha, they can all hear him screaming and banging against the thing.
Oh, I love things like that.
So the thing is, Major Tom could have been like that, but he chooses to in a quite I guess one could say a Hindu sense, to just accept what cannot be changed and acknowledge that he is in this tin can. But essentially, it's like that episode of Space 1999.
Planet Earth is blue and there's nothing I can do.
Exactly.
There's nothing I
letting
can do.
Letting go of what you cannot control.
What a remarkable song for somebody who's barely into their 20s to write. Yeah. But one last thing on this is, again, to come back to the orchestration, because as well as this, at the time, the novelty of the stylophone, which, looking back at it now, is, you know, it's a little bit cheesy and a little bit naff, but I love the...
They're tiny, aren't they?
The zing, you know, it's like a little... sort of little prong. And
it's almost like running a wire along.
But you used to hear them in horror movies, like the Hammer horror movies would always have a stylophone, you know, when the vampire was just around the corner and just heading your way. But I love the gentle sweeps of the orchestration on this, on Space Oddity. Mm. It's just so beautiful. And I mean, people have also made an allusion to drugs. Like, it's like a very... I mean, people make allusions to drugs for anything, you know, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, isn't this, or whatever. But it has a wonderful kind of lost, blissed out kind of, indifference, like you say.
It's perfect storytelling.
It's great storytelling. The lyric is so compact.
Well, it's like a miniature film because, you know, Ground Control to Major Tom, it's not a narrator telling you what's going on. You're actually hearing the voices speaking to each other. And only then do you kind of get a third person at all. I mean, you couldn't... If you actually saw the lyrics... I've got the lyrics in front of me, haven't I? With the countdown. Can we talk about the countdown?
Yes.
So my favourite bit on the whole song is when the countdown keeps going, but they're singing over the top.
Check ignition and may God's love be with you. Yeah. Lift off. He did a live version, I think, in the late 70s, where he actually does, he vocalises the lift off, and it is a bit...
I'm not so bothered about that. It's just having the confidence to have the countdown going and deliver it the way it's delivered. You know, all these different parts of the machine, and then the story over the top.
It's
a masterpiece of storytelling and of constructing a perfect short story.
Well, the lyrics are very compact, very economical. You know, there's very little extraneous stuff there. It's everything's moving forward. Every line moves on to the next. There's not very much ambiguity there. Unwashed and Somewhat Slightly Dazed is one of my favourite songs on this album.
I love that even without knowing anything about David Bowie, you can kind of guess where the song might be coming from.
Right.
And it is about him being this bit of rough and presumably... I think... And also at this time, was he experimenting with being a bit unwashed?
You hit the nail on the head with being a bit of rough, because do you remember at the time he was... And her presence really pervades this album. Hermione Farthingale
was
his very posh girlfriend, very, very middle class. And he always did have... To loop back to what you were saying earlier, he always had this very, very acute sense of class awareness, and he was aware that his origins were rather more humble than hers. And so I think, and he said in interviews, you know, this song is about, you know, being looked down on slightly as this, you know, slightly spotty oik going out with this incredibly refined, posh, middle class girl who'd been trained as a dancer, who ultimately would leave him and then go off to Italy or somewhere. And of course, that later in the album we get to that in more detail. Yeah. But I think that's the ostensible narrative here.
You see, and also you can hear so much David Bowie-ness in it already. Mm. So the way it uses the guitar, I mean, that's part of the reason I feel Space Oddity paves into this beautifully. Yeah. You know, it almost segues into it. It's got a very similar guitar sound, acoustic guitar. And then we were speculating on what those kind of bling things on it are. But there are these almost like splashes of kind of... you know, harp sounds or something. There's some kind of plucked string, isn't it, across it. And then it kicks in with that slightly sort of groovy beat, which makes me think of the stuff that was to come in the early 70s, which is a bit more rock and roll. There's rock and roll that kind of comes in here. And I'm always very conscious of the fact that I'm not someone who studies rock music in sort of forensic detail. But you can just tell this is a really brilliantly constructed, interesting... captivating song. And I suppose the experience of listening to it, it's odd to compare anyone to David Bowie, but I remember when I first heard that Nick Drake album, which again someone gave me, you know, and I got given it on vinyl a few years ago. And it's such an exquisite piece of work. It's sort of like, if you imagine John Keats had never been discovered in his lifetime, then you found all his poetry after he died. And I think these albums are like those albums.
Which Nick Drake album was that? Pink Moon.
Yes, that one.
Yes. It was very minimal, that album.
Yeah.
I think it's just him and a guitar.
But there's something about the sort of ethereal quality of it, which reminds me of this album. And I don't know if that's a couple of years earlier or...
That was later. That was later. 72, Pink Moon. 72. I mean, Nick Drake was really heavily afflicted with depression. And he'd recorded two albums, one in 68, 69, which was gorgeous, very lush, lots of woodwind. He recorded another one around 1970, Brighter Later, which was very jazzy. Both of them flopped, and he retreated to his parents in Warwickshire. Had a nervous breakdown, basically, and then out of nowhere just walked into the studio one night in London with his acoustic and just recorded that album, Pink Moon, over the course of two nights. And then he died in 74, an overdose. But that Pink Moon is an interesting album that you mentioned, because the intensity on that album is breathtaking. When you listen to that album in its whole, it's just mind-blowing.
It's almost shocking, and that's why I think the same with this album. It's almost shocking that he's exposing so much of personal feeling in the lyrics. And each song is so beautifully constructed, so they are like perfect poems, and there's all this interesting orchestration. So I still can't get over this as an early David Bowie album, because I think you can see all the things he was doing later, and which is the one with the... Wakeman does the amazing
Hunky Dory,
Life on Mars. You know, if you think about something like that,
yes.
And that's, I suppose, is arguably the ultimate symbol of a David Bowie song.
Yeah.
You know, the ambition and the beauty and the kind of grandeur of it. But actually, all those elements are on here in different ways.
These themes he would come back to time and time again, even on that first album. I keep going back to.
I'm going to listen to the album now.
The first album. He's talking about things on there like transvestitism. He's talking about on Hunky Dory. He talks about the coming race. I did this with Nick Pegg on the previous edition of the podcast, and there he's talking about, you know, there are lots of songs there about we are little children, you know. The children have all the secrets. The children know the truth. You know, almost like the children are a privileged race apart from the adults. But these things keep coming again. You're very right in saying this album, I think, is the most heartfelt, because there are songs which we'll come shortly to, Letter to Hermione.
Which is the next track, isn't it?
Well, let's come to it now, where it's so painful. You know, it's almost like he's scrabbling to articulate what's in his heart. And on the one hand, it could just be seen as, you know, heartbreak, you left me, I hate you. But it's more about trying to negotiate within himself, do I tell you this? Or how can I tell you this? Or do you understand how much I felt? And it's a song of regret, isn't it?
I guess so. I'll just go back to say one thing about Unwashed and Somewhat Slightly Dazed, which is, think of it, it's a kind of song that anticipates Pulp's Common People, isn't it?
Yes.
and there's a line in it about the cream of the great utopia dream, and you're the gleam in the depths of your bank of spleen. I think some of the rhyming in this is a little bit
tortured,
but it's quite sweet. Those are the moments. I think if there's weaknesses on this album, it's actually, look at the lyrics, some of it is a bit silly, but actually he just carries it off, doesn't he? Because he's got that self-belief. No one else could get away with that. But I do think it is that. I think it must have been that sense by 69 as well, of you'd seen all those working class heroes. And I'd read a thing, in fact, I wrote a piece for the Little Atoms blog about David Bowie's reading, because he'd published a list on his website,
hadn't he, about his reading. Yeah.
And Billy Lyre was on it.
Right.
And he'd seen all these working class actors be kind of lauded, and some of them went on to big Hollywood careers, and, you know, everyone was in love with them all. But actually, the reality of being working class... when you weren't in a black and white art house film, was very different. And I think that's part of what that song captures, is the kind of huge gap between people's professed admiration for working class British social realism and the reality of coming from a rough house. And I remember Donna Gillespie saying, you know, his house was really small and his parents two armchairs with faith in the TV. and the you know, the laundry and everything. And she said it was like out of a film, except you didn't really see that many films like that even then, and just that sense that he was desperately not fitting in. He did not want to be there.
But do you think, was he wasn't really, I mean, he didn't come from a very poor background, did he? I mean, his dad was quite a quite a senior official at Dr. Bernardo's,
yeah,
and was quite prominent, and I believe was, and also was very supportive of his son's musical career. I mean, up to his death in 69, 70, I think he died just before the Free Festival that Bowie sings about here.
And what did he die of? That's so young.
Yeah, I think he died of pneumonia or something. But and Bowie was devastated because his father really believed in him. His mum was a bit eccentric and a bit difficult, and they always had a very, very strained relationship, Bowie and his mother. But he was very close to his father. And I mean, yes, they weren't rich by any means, but I think he wasn't, like, you know, absolute down and out.
No, sorry, I'm making it sound like he's some kind of urchin. I have interesting thoughts about Letter to Hermione. So for a start, again, third track in a row,
yeah,
they do segue into each other beautifully. Mm. So it's, this is definitely a record that you want to listen to on vinyl because there's a joy to putting it on and listening to it, the flow of tracks. It's beautifully constructed. But also, I think there's an element of parody of, you know, those sort of 60s sort of romantic films where there'll be, I mean, it's almost like that, what's that film, is it 69 as well, one with raindrops keep falling on my head, you know, that really weird song from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid when they're riding on a bicycle. It's bizarre. Catherine Ross and Paul Newman, but he's almost parodying that,
yeah,
kind of soft focus romantic,
yeah,
thing,
yeah,
at the beginning,
yeah,
and then it turns into, as you say, something that's actually quite a sort of dark admission of grief and loss, and, you know, will you have me back. Yeah, it's one of those things where I kind of feel I want to keep my distance from David Bowie's feelings because I feel a bit, what's the word for it? Voyeuristic. I feel voyeuristic thinking too much about them. Yes, I just feel bad.
Don't you see the absolute contortions of pain and of self-doubt? Because this breakup, he was talking about it years later, it really, really affected him. Because not only was it a romantic breakup, but I think we keep touching on this issue of class. And I think her rejection of him, or however it panned out, I don't know the details, must have also been quite a crushing blow to his aspirations of, you know, that very suburban idea of bettering yourself,
yeah,
or, you know, moving on. Maybe it, you know, it touched on a number of different levels.
I guess that there's part of me that approaches David Bowie as I did as a teenager, which is, you know, as a teenage girl listening to songs, and he's a pop star, and I don't necessarily need to know.
It's a bit too much. Okay. I don't want to know.
I just know, as I say, I really feel like I'm prying into his private life where I shouldn't
but he's,
be.
He's
whereas the lyrics,
it for you.
Yes, and the thing, what's interesting is if you compare it to the pop idols who'd have been aware of, like Bobby V and all those,
yeah,
you know, those teen heartthrobs of the 50s,
yeah,
who would sing these songs as, you know, that seemed to be really heartfelt about why is she going out with him when,
yeah,
I'm the one who loves her, and if only she knew what they were saying about her behind her back. And you know, it's all a construct, and these songs are being written in the Brill Building,
yeah,
and
yeah,
there's nothing genuine about them other than to appeal to young teenage girls. This is the real deal.
Right, and it's a bit much.
Yeah, and well, I don't know. No, I'm not saying it's a bit much. It's just that, I don't know, it's almost like I want to...
Do we like our David to be a bit more aloof and remote? And then when he gets intimate, it's a bit shocking. You know, it's like if, when you have a friend who's always very self-possessed and always in control, and then you meet that friend one day and she's all upset and just like spilling out secrets.
Basically, I'm happy that David Bowie constructed a version of himself,
yeah,
and I loved the way he would change those incarnations. I respected that, and I kind of respect his right to, for me to be distant from it. And yet at the same time, I acknowledge that the thing about his early fandom, and part of what fascinated me about Sharma Pereira and other girls like her, was that they showed their feelings for him, and they went round, and he loved it, and there was a,
yeah,
symbiotic relationship. He thrived on the adoration of those young girls, and in that sense, I guess I'm just saying that I wasn't one of them. I admire them, and I admire,
right,
what they gave him, and what he, and he respected them. And I think that if there's one thing I want to come out of my taking part in this podcast, it's my real frustration that David Bowie's rock history has too often been written by just writing the women out of his story.
Mm.
You know, Angie Bowie's been written out, but she did amazing stuff with him. And I saw her interviewed in a Channel 4 documentary about disco and gay culture, and you just think she was so important, and she still is. And all these teenage girls, if you look at them, who dress like him, who adored him at a time when they would have been mocked, and you know how teenage girls, and anyone who, any band which has a big teen following, with the exception of the Beatles, usually gets mocked by the music press. It happened to Duran Duran, it happened,
yeah,
to lots of other bands. And I think that's one of the reasons why they've been written out of David Bowie's rock history, is that because guys like him, and I'm not knocking all the guys listening to it, but certain rock critics, you'd think there was no girl fans who were part of his early story. And they were. They were a big part of his early story.
And I think you're very right to mention this, because
he loved girls. He loved him.
And he was always surrounded by very strong women. If you look, I mean, Peggy, his mother, was a very strong, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but no doubt a very strong influence on him. Mary Finnegan, who you mentioned earlier, supported him, and they became lovers for a while. She was another very strong figure in his life, and, you know, anecdotally, she returned one day to find Angie in the kitchen, and Angie then suggested they all exist together.
Oh, Carol, I didn't tell
you
about that.
And maybe not. But for a while, they did, you know, cohabit altogether.
And it seemed to be mutually respectful. I mean, yeah. I think it's really significant that Caroline's memories, and she was a teenage girl, was he was entirely respectful.
Yeah.
You know, she just adored him. There was never any sense.
Well, Mary was a radio producer as well, wasn't she?
Yeah. Yeah. But I think, you know, when you think about some of the horrible stories that have emerged about how pop stars have behaved towards underage girls, and indeed DJs as well, this normalisation that you could sleep with 13-year-olds, that was completely normalised in some rock circles at that time, certainly through the 70s. And I get the sense that David Bowie just seemed to... You know what? The thing I love about David Bowie is he's an artist and he's a gentleman.
Going back to this very important question about women in his life, we had Hermione, we had Angie, we had Mary, Dana Gillespie, Susie Fussy, who then became Mrs. Mick Ronson.
Cherry Vanilla.
And we're just now into the early 70s, but all these women were crucial in their own way.
I interviewed Susie.
Really?
We interviewed about the costumes.
Right.
And she talked about how, because, you know, they were made to fit that amazing, narrow, androgynous body of his.
Yeah.
But you think about these performances and how sweaty he got. And she said they would actually be painting over the sweat marks and almost painting the holes
over.
They
didn't have much time, did they?
They didn't have much time, and those costumes had to last.
And would he wear the same costume? No, he would change quite a lot.
He would change, but, you know, all of them would be in quite a state.
Yeah.
And she had to basically, you know, I think she talked about painting over patches.
Oh, my God. This improvisation that you need on the road. But that, again, underlines the importance of these. Because if you hadn't had Angie egging him on and pushing him, really, to come up with, you know, the whole Ziggy universe, which I think she was a huge part of, he had the ideas, but he wasn't necessarily the greatest one at activating those ideas and realising how best to convey them. Angie was a master of communication. I think she really understood.
And being
that.
An American, I think there's really interesting stories about the Americans who came to London in the late 60s and the glamour that they brought with them, and also the fact that they clearly loved. God, you'd have to love Britain to want to live in London.
Can you imagine how grim it must have been?
Well, I'll say that. My parents have wonderful memories of the 60s, too.
Right.
Obviously, it was an amazing time in its own way. But I think that whole cross fertilisation of American culture and Britishness is what creates some of these most amazing
definitely, because you have that British reticence and then you have that American go-getting spirit. So look at people like, say, we've mentioned Nick Drake now. Nick Drake's producer, Joe Boyd, was an American and he was quite a posh Harvard kid. He came over because of his love of music, set up a folk label and discovered Fairport Convention and, you know, Sandy Denny and all these people. And because these people were by nature quite reticent, Richard Thompson especially, and Joe Boyd with his American good humour and get up and go was the one saying, you know, come on, or Angie Bowie, or Tony Visconti.
The other one I was thinking of is Robert Brownjohn, who was the art designer and photographer. He came from the advertising world in New York, and he actually came to London apparently because the heroin was easier to get on.
Yes, well, he can get on prescription.
Yeah. And he, of course, did the Let It Bleed cover for the Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
I remember interviewing his daughter when they had a retrospective exhibition, but again, an American who'd come from the golden age, the real madman era of American advertising, and brought all that visual thinking, of course, to the title sequences to Goldfinger and From Russia with Love.
Really?
Yeah, you know, the projections on the on the dancer's body.
But I love the fact that it was because of the decent heroin on prescription. I remember reading in Keith Richards' book that you could go to the doctor, get a prescription, and then get your weekly dose of pure Merc heroin or cocaine. And a lot of dealer, and actually, no, he said, by some weird quirk, if you went and got a prescription, you'd also be given a bottle of cocaine. It was meant to help.
God, I have to say, it all sounds really sleezy too. Robert Brownjohn died so young.
Yeah, but I mean, of course, at the time, we didn't know, you know, long-term effects of cocaine or whatever that came later. At that time,
didn't we?
I don't, not in the rock world. I mean, I think I've read lots of books where people said, you know, cocaine habits developed and no one was really, especially in the 70s.
What did we know about David Bowie's drug taking at this time? Because it seems to me...
He
needed to be sober because he wanted to be in charge.
I don't think, I mean, I'm not 100% sure, but I don't think he was a big pothead. He didn't really like weed.
He wouldn't have done, would he?
It wasn't his speed, was it? It wasn't his fitting his character. I'm sure he'd like to drink, but I mean, I don't think there was any significant drug use at this time.
Always thought someone should write the David Bowie diet book. Because, you know, you just keep, you know, you keep hearing these stories about what he was and wasn't surviving
on.
Milk, I knew you were going to say milk and peppers. And I actually found myself thinking about this a lot because you just think, oh, but wouldn't the peppers curdle the milk? Like, wouldn't that be really, it sounds really bad. And then lots of black coffee. I know he drank a lot of black coffee. But because, that's the other thing, that David Bowie has a special presence in my home because when I was raising my children, one, we used to play a lot of his music, but then they started to think of him as this absent relative who sort of bestowed advice. And so when my daughter was about 4 or 3, we were at the breakfast table and my son wasn't eating and we tried to think of, like, oh, you know, David Beckham always eats a good breakfast before he plays a football match, you know, as if that would work. And my daughter just went, David Bowie always eats a good breakfast before he goes to parties. And he just thought, the parties thing is spot on. But actually, he probably didn't eat a good breakfast. But I just thought it'd be great because, you know, he did. It's a little thing to say he did look good in it. I mean, he sometimes looked really frightening.
That's the terrible thing. My peak favourite Bowie look is that period where he was eating peppers. And
see, I don't. It's when it was his Let's Dance era.
Oh,
that's
you,
when
you,
all the
you
girls
like the Let's
loved
Dance era,
him.
Like,
yeah,
the zoot
blonde
suits
hair.
And
I forget, it's the one time I've seen him live, and it's never been rebroadcast. I went to that first Prince's Trust concert at Wembley Arena, and Prince Charles and Lady Di were there, Princess Di were there, dancing in the Royal Box. And he and Mick Jagger came on unannounced and did
Dancing
in the Streets.
Yes.
And for some reason, it was always edited out of the rebroadcast of that. So it's never been seen since.
I just remember
thinking how beautiful.
It's on YouTube, that particular performance. I think it's just because it was pretty bad. They were clearly, I think, a bit refreshed.
Oh, I was really far away. I couldn't tell.
Dig it out on YouTube sometime. I was Googling for something.
Are you sure it's that?
It was a Prince's Trust. It was shortly after Live Aid.
Yeah,
so
that
their,
been it.
Their profile was
that
still...
That would have been
it. And I think they came on, it was...
He had a kind of stripy suit.
Yes,
yeah.
And I think...
I didn't know he was stoned out of his head.
Well, he wasn't stoned, but I mean, I think they were... Clearly
bouncy.
They were somewhat.
They were very bouncy.
Celebratory.
I thought it was lovely. I thought they were just happy.
Yeah. This. I thought they were happy. No, they were.
I think I was about 14.
There's a great. There's a great Bowie smashed out of his skull on TV moment on Soul Train when he did Golden Years and Fame, and this was I think late 75, early 76, and of course Soul Train, you know, huge in America, and he was only the second white artist to be invited on. It was a big honour. And I can't remember the name of the presenter, but it was this big bear of a man.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the de rigueur kind of like check, yellow check, you know, garish check, you know, sports jacket, the great mid 70s look, massive moustache and sides and tinted frames and a big afro. And this beautiful big, like, okay, I'd like to welcome Mr. David Bowie. And Bowie comes on and he's trashed. He'd been doing tons of coke, he's drunk.
Oh, really?
And it's really sad. I read in one of the biographies that after the filming, this guy took him aside and basically said, hey, kid, you're screwing up. You're screwing up. Get yourself together.
Oh, and did it make the difference?
It contributed. I think that was around the time he decided to clean up and move to Europe because his time, 76, I think, was the absolute nadir of his personal life. It's drug use.
See, this is the other thing, because the very first article I ever wrote for the internet back in 2010 was... How to Raise Your Kids, the David Bowie way. And it wasn't actually raising your kids like David Bowie, but lessons from David Bowie. And one of them was that when things had got too much, he wasn't afraid to step away and abandon fame. Mm. When the temptation would have been to reclaim it in some mad scrambling way, but to actually completely step away and go to somewhere like Berlin and sort of hunker down and re-establish yourself as an artist with yourself.
That's exactly what he did. I think he said afterwards that I had to leave, I had to get out, what am I doing, reassess everything, because he'd been more or less on a roller coaster since Ziggy, you know, and what a roller coaster. He'd gone from Ziggy Stardust to Aladdin Sane to Diamond Dogs to Young American
but also being somewhere like Berlin, one, the whole weirdness of it, but also the whole thing about, you know, you live in Berlin, of being a stranger in a strange land, and I know Berlin is full of, you know, Americans and Brits, and to some extent always has been, But you definitely, it helps you get to check of that ego, doesn't it?
No one knew who he was. Yeah. Famously, he would cycle around town in a flat cap and not be bothered. And I know people in Berlin now that knew him or were familiar with him back in the day. There are certain bars in Kreuzberg that he went to. I mean, you know Berlin as well.
Yeah, I used to work there.
He would hang out at SO36 on Oranienstrasse. There's a bar on near Kottbusser Dam.
Kottbusser Tor.
From Kottbusser Tor, you get Kottbusser Dam and then towards the bridge. And there's a bar just there called Horvath's. But that used to be Exil, where he and Iggy used to hang out every night. And there are a lot of anecdotes about that bar. But it was funny because, he reached that absolute bottom, lowest of the lows, to excuse a pun, and went to the heroin capital of Europe.
maybe not entirely smart.
And there we have it. That's Samira Ahmed and myself chatting about Space Oddity and a whole lot more in a secret bunker location somewhere in London. And I really must thank Samira for not only bringing a veritable kaleidoscope of ideas, theories, questions, answers, and more to this edition, but for her kindness and patience in accommodating this recording into a very, very packed schedule. Her excellent Bowie documentary, I Dress Ziggy Stardust, is actually still on the BBC iPlayer, and it's absolutely brilliant, so do check it out. So, from me then, that's it for this edition of Album to Album. Please, as ever, do like, share, and share again across the social media universe, and I'll be back with part two as soon as possible. In the meantime, I hope you've enjoyed it, thank you for listening, and I'll see you soon.